Welcome to the Trailblazing Texas podcast, where we embark on a journey through our diverse Texas landscapes and breathtaking trails while always engaging with our amazing Texas hiking community. So settle in, tighten up those bootlaces, and get ready for the thrilling tales awaiting for you on this episode.
Put your phone on airplane mode. You don't need to be on. You don't need to be on Facebook. You don't need to be texting anybody.
Even if you're an influencer, pause that. You can still make videos.
Still make videos. Stuff. Totally. Yep. Put your phone in airplane mode. Right. Yep. It does. Those navigation programs do not need the cellular part of your phone in order to work. They work via the GPS, the little GPS locator that's in there that talks to satellites up in the atmosphere. When you are in airplane mode, obviously this depends on how old your phone is and how old your battery is and those kinds of things. But when you're in airplane mode, you can run if you start with a full charge, you know, so charge your phone in your car on the way to the trailhead. And if you put your phone in airplane mode, you can run for about 3 days on most phones, right?
Yeah.
Before your battery is going to go dead. If the cellular part of it is shut off, if you're in airplane mode. And so it extends the battery life of your phone by about 300 to 400%. It's significant, right?
That's crazy.
And then the other thing too is like, know if you're going to carry a battery brick in your backpack, like you'd recommend people to do, know how many charges you're going to get out of it. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like this is, you wouldn't dare go on a 3-night trip into the backcountry of Guadalupe without counting out your liters of water. You know what I'm saying? Like you know how many you need per day because you've done it before.
Yep.
You know that on a terrible day, I need this much water. And sometimes when I don't do much sweating, I maybe only need this much. And you're going to probably be a little bit conservative, right? Because it's not just one day, you're going out for 3 days and you're going to think through it, right? You're going to do the math in your mind and you're going to figure out like how much water do I need? Well, yep. Goodness gracious. If you're going to be in a situation where navigation, you know, either will be or might be an issue, why wouldn't you treat your phone's battery the same way that you did the amount of ounces and liters and gallons of water? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so test that out on a day hike. Put your phone in airplane mode. Put it, you know, open up your, whether it's All Trails or I use Gaia.
Yep.
Actually track, you know, and time it. Okay, I was out for 6 hours. I started out at 100%. I had my phone in airplane mode. I tracked this whole hike for 6 hours, and I went from, you know, whatever it is, 100% down to 77%. So I know I used, you know, 25% to be conservative. So that means if I'm on a backpack, and then you can start to figure out, oh, okay. Well, I have an accurate understanding of how long this battery is going to work. And then same thing with your battery brick, you know, actually run your phone down till it's dead at home and charge it with that battery brick and then keep doing it until that battery brick has no more charge left. And then, yep, you know, okay, I get 2.5 charges or 3¾ charges or whatever, you know, treat your battery capacity and the very important, you know, tool in your kit that is that, you know, that application on your cell phone, treat it with the same exactness that you would when you're, you know, counting out your calories. You wouldn't just throw some food in a pile and say, oh, I think that's probably enough for 4 days. You know what I mean? Like, no, you're going to be like, okay, breakfast on this day is this and dinner is this. And like, you know, you're going to accurately, you're going to do a real careful job of making sure you have the right amount of calories for 4 days. Treat your cell phone battery the same way.
And there's so many aspects of understanding your water capacity on cold days, hot days, understanding how fast you on a flat hike, how many miles per hour do you normally do, in elevation, how many, you know, 1 mile per hour, 2 miles per hour, because you could literally look at a paper map. It's okay. I've been hiking an hour on a flat track. I'm usually hiking 2.8, 3.3 miles per hour. So I should be here or around there.
Yeah.
Yeah. The food, like go hiking and eat the food, see how it reacts with your body? Mm-hmm. Do you have stomach issues? Does it make you sick to your stomach? Understand like what will give you a quick boost of energy, like hard candy or, you know, these types of things when you need that, that boost. Yeah. Like, and on the, you know, and what's funny is people do this, but then when they go on the backpacking trip, they have salami and then they get sick to their stomach. And I'm like, well, did you have salami before when we were out test hiking? No. Yeah. Why'd you do something different?
Not a backpacking trips are not a place for doing anything novel.
Yes.
With food.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Like every aspect of everything to do with backpacking and hiking, you should have an understanding of your equipment,
it's kind of a, sometimes you've asked pet peeves that you've asked that question of some of your guests or something to correct or whatever. But yeah, that's one of mine is like everybody does realize that there is like an intrinsic value in these navigational applications that you can get for your phone. But nobody seems to know like how they work and what kind of, you know, and what kind of battery they require. And so what ends up happening is, you know, somebody ran out of battery, their phone went dead, they got lost, and then, you know, and then they got rescued, and it all ends up like, and then what happens? Yeah. These, you know, these silly applications and this dumb technology. No, the technology is not silly. It's not dumb at all. In fact, it's far superior to the old technology, but you got to know how it works.
Yeah. That's, you know, and like, I think one of the episodes I'm like, you should be a master, a savant on one app.
You
should be really good at another app, and you should be, you know, like proficient and at three apps, because, you know, sometimes I don't need Gaia. All Trails is fine. But so I need to understand downloading the offline capabilities and all that. Sometimes I put together routes in Gaia, print out the map, but I also need to understand how that, like, that's probably for a more dangerous backpacking or hiking trip is, you know, I'm using Gaia, so I better understand how that sucker works.
But airplane mode. Yes. And it's just like, even if you're just going on a day hike and you're not going to bring a battery brick, you know, I put it on airplane mode. And then if, you know, if something horrific and terrible happens and I don't know, I sprain my ankle and, you know, now I'm in a situation where I can't walk out and I'm spending the night unexpectedly. If I had my phone in airplane mode, I'm probably still at 80 or 90%. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I'm not in a bind in that way. I can't stress that enough. Like, you know, you're in airplane mode, your phone is going to last 3 or 4 days. Most people's.
Yeah. And test it. Yeah. Like, you know, not this last episode that dropped, but the one before that, the gentleman in Colorado, Jamie, you know, like on bad weather days, instead of driving into Rocky Mountain National Park, he just goes kind of down the street, you know, maybe 30 minutes away, and it's cold, it's windy, and he has his GPS and, you know, testing out like, this is a really cold day. What's the battery life going to be like that? What's the battery life going to be like that on my phone? And it gave him a cold error warning. And so like, he knows, okay, you know, if I'm experiencing days like this, I need to put it,
gotta keep maybe it in
inside. Yeah. Pocket, inside the layers, next to my, body. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, even if there is cell phone service where you're at, put it in airplane mode. Right. And then if you end up in a situation where something happens and you're calling for a rescue, you know, you're going to have, you'll have that battery capacity left.
Yeah. You definitely will. It'll be almost a guarantee that you're going to have the power that you need to save your life. And at the end of the day, you're out hiking anyway, just do it. Like, understand all this stuff. You know, it's not like you're not out pre-hiking or, you know, like looking around, like, you know, sometimes we go out and just do exploratory hikes. Like, okay, we're going to do a backpacking trip on this trail. We do sections of it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so you should have ample time to get an understanding of all this as it relates to the trail that you're on.
Yeah. Like in regards to that, like I assume you're kind of referencing the Lone Star Trail, and then you go out and you check out the sections, and you're probably thinking like, oh, okay, well, where am I going to probably end up camping? And you're checking out campsites and that kind of stuff.
No,
you can also lay down a track, right? When you're just out for the day. And then you don't even need as much battery capacity when you go to actually do the hike, because all your tracks are already on your app. Yep. So at any point in time, you can just hit that button to turn on your GPS unit to find your ping on the map, and you'll know yep. where you are in relationship to the trail, that because you've already put the track down.
Yeah. I was in a sketchy situation. It wasn't a sketchy situation, but it was probably, out of all my situations, it really got me for a second until I kind of just calmed down. But I was on Lone Star Hiking Trail on a loop, this one loop, and I've never been on the loop. And due to the hurricane, there was no more trail. It was just all fallen trees and wiped out.
Yeah.
And so I said, look, I want to try to navigate through this. And I was using a paper map and a compass and just see, like, you know, what kind of trouble I can get into. And then, so I brought up, I wasn't very successful. I just felt like, okay, I'm lost. You know, I knew I needed to follow this creek. And then, you know, then I knew there was a big right turn, and I wasn't successful, but it was fun. But then I turned on my phone, or, you know, brought it up and went to All Trails, because, you know, I had that. And then I couldn't get the phone, or I couldn't get the map. And I said, oh crap, I forgot to download it. And then, you know, it wouldn't pull up. And I was like, oh. So then I don't remember what I did, but I don't know. I had maybe an old map on a different app. Like, so anyway, but I was able to get it. But for there, I started to panic, like, okay, I have a paper map. I know that I'm lost. And now the All Trails didn't pull up the map because I didn't download it. So I had to stop, take a deep breath. I'm going to be okay. And, you know, and work through the issue, but it was fun. You know, yeah. I knew I wasn't going to die. And then, like, once I kind of figured out, okay, I got the app working and stuff, I took three steps and there was a cotton mouth that, that about 8 inches away from my foot. Oops. So that was kind of like the little icing on the cake for that experience.
Yeah.
So we have poisonous snakes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I definitely remember the rattlesnakes growing up there in West Texas.
Yeah.
And scorpions.
So coming up and hiking, let's talk about fall, winter. How, just not extreme hikes, but how common, or how much of it is something that we need to look at, you know, for avalanches and rock falls?
Rockfall, I can't really think of any established hiking trails where rockfall would be a major issue. That's almost always going to be a mountaineering phenomenon, and there's a lot of it in the mountains here. Rockfall is extremely prevalent in the Pacific Northwest, and that's just because of the rock's volcanic. And because it's volcanic, it's all constantly like deteriorating. And being up on a Mount Rainier or a Mount Hood, if you're coming from a place of, you know, maybe climbing Long's Peak in Colorado, or some of the 14ers and 13ers in Wyoming, in the Wind River Range, for example, the one thing you would notice right away is that the volcanoes in the Pacific Northwest are noisy places. There is constant rockfall. But I can't really think of any hiking trails where rockfall would be an issue. But avalanches are just extremely common. And there's a whole lot of things that
extremely common on, like, normal, like, the, you know, we did the Paradise, and we were going up to Muir Snowfields,
where you got kind of uncomfortable and we turned around. Multiple people have died right there. Right in that
exact. I knew you were trying to kill me.
when we were there, there hadn't been a storm cycle in 10 days, and there had been a bunch of freeze thaws, so avalanche danger would have been extremely low. I mean, it doesn't mean it's impossible. It's never impossible. But that slope that you got kind of uncomfortable on, that's the sweet spot for avalanches. Avalanches don't like too flat, and they also don't like too steep. There's a certain degrees. It's between 27 and 32 degrees, but that's what they love. And that's right in the sweet spot of it. That little chute hits typically call it the winter route up to Panorama Point, which right after Panorama Point is the Mirror Snowfield. Avalanche danger is a serious issue on lots of hikes. And so, I mean, the hiking community here in Washington is huge. So one of the places a listener could go is they could join the group Washington Hikers and Climbers. It's a Facebook group. There's like 150,000 members, I think. But every year about October, somebody will bring up these posts, but there's like a whole list of trails that you can hike in the wintertime that have no avalanche danger. Rattlesnake Ledge that you did with Mia is one of them. Mm-hmm. Mount Si, the one that I did with my mom in that really bad wind that one day, that's another one. But anyway, there's actual, you know, whole lists of hikes that people have put together that are deliberately made for hiking in the wintertime when avalanche danger could be an issue. Or if you've taken avalanche courses and you understand that stuff, very often there's ways to navigate around, you know, dangerous avalanche slopes. You just have to know how to read it and know what's what and be able to look at a blank canvas, I guess, of snow and be able to point out the places that are likely to be dangerous and the places that are likely to be safe. But that's kind of hiking in the wintertime. There's a slight downtick, I guess, in the number of people that are out hiking in the winter, but not much.
I think that would be I love winter. I hate summer. So I think
culture in the Pacific Northwest is, I mean, the outdoor hiking culture is just, it's so prevalent that it's, I forget the name of the comedian, but there's some comedian that, you know, is nationally known and does things or whatever, where he does this joke about the Pacific Northwest. And he says, you know, when you're in Seattle or you're in Portland, everybody's dressed like a hike could break out at any minute.
Yeah, I heard that guy. Yeah. Yep.
A hike might break out.
Yeah. That's true. You know, one thing I got that was pretty amazing, visiting you guys and visiting Mia up in Washington and never had an idea, like a clue, is that Native American, the history has up there.
Yeah.
And so are there any trails in Washington that are, have any kind of significant historical aspect or cultural importance?
Lots of them. Sometimes it's might be known to the Native American community that, you know, that inhabited those places, and other times it's known to everyone. I mean, part of it right away is just names. I mean, I live in Chehalis, which is the Chehalis Indian tribe. down the road from me is the Skykomish River, which is the name that the natives gave to it. One thing that is very common, and I know this kind of touches on, you know, some kind of volatile political stuff, but is the native names of things, and why do we call things what we call them? Sometimes people take it a little far up here. This is certainly a very liberal part of the country, but it is very common to say, you know, I'm going to go hiking at Mount Rainier or Tahoma, because Tahoma is what the natives referred to it before European settlers got here. Or it's common to say, you know, we're standing on the land of the such and such. But there's tons of Native American influence here. People have been inhabiting it for who even knows how long. And they obviously have legends about, there's a legend about Crater Lake. And the natives can remember when Crater Lake erupted and formed down there in southern Oregon. You know, that they think that Mount Mazama, which is what they called it, was actually the tallest of all of them. It was actually bigger than Mount Rainier. You can just look at the mountain and sort of imagine that the top wasn't cut off, and it's probably around 15 to 16,000 feet tall. Mount Mazama was, and they have legends about how, I think it was Mount Shasta was mad at Mount Mazama. I don't know. I don't know all the various legends and stuff that they have, but we also have some trails. Cascade Pass is a famous one in the North Cascades that you can actually walk from the west side of the state all the way down to the east side of the state. But that was literally a Native American trail. They obviously European settlers have improved it and done this, that, and the other thing. But it was literally trails that were used by the natives. There's down in the Columbia River Gorge, not far from Dog Mountain, there's another mountain that you can hike, and there's a bunch of Native American graves up near the summit of a little thing called Wind Mountain. There's definitely like a heavy Native presence in the way that we name things and some of the various trails that we now use had been being walked on by human feet hundreds of years before my ancestors got here. Yeah, just to name a few.
Yeah, there's Mission Tejas State Park here in Texas, about an hour from my house, maybe a little bit more. But part of the Real something road that the early road that the Spanish settlers developed is still there, and you can walk on it, and it's from like the 1500s, 1600s.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so it's, I didn't read all the history, but it was, I read was pretty cool. And that's one thing about Washington hiking and backpacking. The hardest thing about that area is the pronunciation of these trails and state parks. It's not the hikes, it's not the mountaineering, it's not the 10,000 feet of elevation gain over a half a mile. It's pronouncing these names.
Yeah. I mean, I've lived here so long, I guess I'm just used to it now. So, but I always feel that way when I'm looking at maps of Alaska up where Megan's family lives. It's like,
yeah,
what are all these U's and G's and K's?
So when it starts to approach hiking season, how are you discovering new trails? Like what's your process of discovering new trails or, kind of planning what your season's going to look like?
Yeah. So we have everybody in Washington's going to know this, but there's a website that anybody can go to if you're planning on coming to Washington, and it has it's WTA. I think it's WTA.org if I'm not mistaken, but it's Washington Trails Association. And on their website, there's a hike finder map, and it shows, you can zoom in and out, but it has the whole entire state of Washington. And then it has every hike in the state of Washington cataloged on there. There's thousands.
Oh my God.
And so there, and so when you zoom all the way out, it'll just show you where the big clusters are at. Sometimes it's just like one hike by itself. That might be like over in Eastern Washington or whatever, but then the more you zoom in, it'll start to separate and it'll kind of show you, but I don't know, more and more I like solitude. I don't like crowds. But I still do. I still go to the most popular hikes in Washington. I just go early.
No.
Yeah. Like you do that too. Like, you love when you're in down there in Guadalupe, at least one of your hikes is always going to be headlamping it up and then watching the sunrise from up top somewhere.
If it's 3:30 in the morning, I'm not on the trail, then I've messed up.
Yeah. I mean, I can go to Paradise at whatever, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning. And they're not, I'm not going to be all alone. But I'll only see a small handful of people, and I can go hike the most popular trails in Washington. Just go early, but then there's also like, I don't know, there's certain areas of the state that there's some areas of the state that I still haven't even been to. The Tianaways is one that I'm really itching to see. So this is on the border of Canada, and it's on the far eastern edge of the Cascades. So it's kind of right where the mountains start to end, and then eventually it turns into flatland and deserts and orchards and all of that kind of stuff. But there's a whole entire network of there's some off trail scrambling and climbing, and then there's some backpacking, just, you know, routes and everything up there in the Tianaways. I've never been up there. The PCT kind of almost goes that far east, way up there. It gets quite a, the PCT for the final 30, 40 miles is quite a ways east of the actual crest. But it's up there in that area of the Tianaways, or like the Alpine Lakes Wilderness is kind of north central Washington. I've only barely scratched the surface of that. That's all. So that's Federal Forest Service land. And a lot of that is kind of rough roads. So, you know, probably want like high clearance vehicle or whatever to get into some of those trailheads. I definitely like to go back and do things over and over again though.
Yeah, me too.
You know, like I remember when I was little, my sister had she would find a movie that she liked and then she'd watch that movie to death, you know, until the stupid VHS broke. I'm kind of that way with hikes too. I have a whole repertoire of about, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 hikes that I like a lot. Dog Mountain's one of them that I did with you, that I go back and I just do them over and over and over again. So to some degree, I'm content with maybe going and checking out new areas, you know, some, but I'm also quite happy. It's a different experience every time, you know, and you know that there's quite a few things in the Guadalupes you've done 4, 5, 6, 7 times, and it's each time's a little different.
Yeah, for sure. What about how would a visitor kind of familiarize themselves with any kind of permitting or regulations to kind of take part? Like, I know for you, the national parks, you pull up, there's usually a kiosk there that you pay.
Yep.
You know, or tell them what they wanted, they give you a map and stuff.
Yep.
But, you know, like, especially the state parks, sometimes the ones that we went to, no one was there. It was just us.
Yeah.
And you would just grab a campsite or.
As far as parking permits go, we have 2 passes that if you just get those, you have everything you need. One is called the Discover Pass, and it's a state pass, and it's good for all state parks. And then the other one is just federal. And goodness, I mean, I don't care whether you live in Texas or Colorado or Arizona or Texas, you should just buy like your mom or grandma, or maybe it's a present your wife gives to you, but like you should have an America the Beautiful pass. It's just the America the Beautiful only, I think it's $100. And it lasts for a year. And it's good at every single national park and all federal lands. So if a permit is required to park on Federal Forest Service land, or you're trying to get into Denali or Glacier National Park or Grand Canyon National Park or Yosemite or Olympic or Rainier, that covers your entrance to any national park, right? And most of those nowadays are, goodness, some of them are $30 or $40 or $50 for, you know, for the 3-day weekend pass. So, you know, if you use the thing twice, it paid for itself. America the Beautiful for federal lands and Discover Pass for state lands. But that website that I mentioned, WTA.org, it also is going to have all the information on parking permits, any kind of other permits that are needed. There's always tons of trip reports, you know, so you can usually find out. Somebody will tell you exactly what the road was like and what the hike was like and what the snow conditions were, you know, just 3 days ago. It's by far the most useful thing that you can access on the internet. Yep.
And do you find it, the questions that are asked on some of these sites, people are pretty nice and respectful?
You know how people are here. I mean, like Washington Hikers and Climbers, that's that Facebook group that I told you about. Anytime you have 150,000 people involved in anything, you're going to have some, you know, you're going to have some a-holes, the guy that runs it, I've actually met him once or twice in the mountains, just ran into him, older gentleman, he constantly preaches that, you know, be nice. Like, yes, I know when somebody asks, you know, is February a good time to through hike the enchantments, that obviously like it's not, and you could probably die doing that, and definitely don't try it, but treat people with respect. They don't know.
Yeah.
Just be nice. There was once upon a time you didn't know, you know? So,
yeah.
So treat people like you would have wanted to be treated.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. I mean, some of these, you know, when I gear up for a hike in Colorado, like some of the Facebook pages that I've asked questions on, like I've never had anybody come to me because I hopefully I can show that, hey, I've tried to do the research. I've done this. But man, to some other people, they've been brutal. And it's just like,
yeah,
it's like, why? Like,
yeah, you can usually on also on WTA, you'll also find like parking information, because there are some hikes are going to have plenty of parking. And then there's definitely other ones where, you know, somebody will wisely tell you, hey, be there by 9 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is, you know, if you want to be able to get a parking spot.
And I think it might, even if I read something and go, okay, you know, that's kind of a, I don't want to say dumb question, but you know, it's whatever. Like, I just don't respond. Like, just don't respond.
Right. Yeah,
you don't have to blast somebody.
Don't have to say anything.
Yeah. So since you've been in Washington for so long, how have you seen the hiking culture in Washington evolve over the years?
Yeah. And it's specialized. It seems like one thing was, I remember the very first time I saw a trail runner. That's wildly popular in Washington now, is trail running. You see, like, sometimes I see more trail runners than I see hikers.
Do you knock them off the trail? It's like skiers and snowboarders.
Yep. Just like people pushing the limits and just doing phenomenal things. And I don't know. It just seems like more and more people like develop a style. I don't know whether it's, you know, I only hike the hardest things. And so, you know, there's this group that they want to, like, you can find whole groups that Mailbox Peak is a famous training hike that we have up on I-90. There's literally a mailbox on the summit.
I think
somebody put it there back in the 60s or 70s. And for the longest time, it was just like, it was only known by the climbing community. And it's really more of a route than it is a trail. Steep as crap. It gains like 4,000 feet in 2 miles. I mean, it's nasty steep, but there's people that'll go and they'll do double mailboxes or triple mailboxes. People go like on the, like they'll just go and they'll hike this thing 3 times in a row, just back to back to back. And it's like, you know, like mileage and elevation becomes a thing, or trail runners. And I don't know. It's just, there's been a lot of, people kind of become specialists, I guess. And then the other huge thing is like Leave No Trace.
How is that?
Out here in the 90s, like there wasn't, like, you know, I mean, people would definitely yell at you if you just like threw your empty can on the ground, something absurd. But it's definitely evolved from, at first when Leave No Trace started to be advocated for, you know, pretty heavily in the community, like it was seen as elitist, you know, like, you know, you people think you're better than us and you're not going to tell me what to do. And just kind of a whole hierarchy of power and all the rest. But I think now we've all come to realize that, like, yeah, this stuff actually matters. Like, and especially in a place like Paradise, where there's, you know, massive numbers of people that are in an area all the time. Like, if every single person just like walked out into that field of flowers to take their picture, well, there wouldn't be a field of flowers anymore. They'd all be just trampled until they were gone, and it just wouldn't exist. And it wouldn't be the beautiful thing that is today. So there's definitely been an evolution over the last 3 decades of, you know, people coming around to embracing the concept of leaving no trace, you know. And
do you find that most people are supporting that?
Oh yeah, big time. Yeah, definitely so. Definitely so.
And what about in the parks? Is it like, you know, like Guadalupe, you go in the backcountry, you have to have wag bags for every night that you are in the backcountry. What is the policies that you've seen state parks, national parks with wag bags and backcountry? Is it?
Yeah.
Are you trialing it or?
So
it
varies from park to park. One common thing that we've seen, in Washington is it's very common for there to just be, pit toilets, or they're actually like plastic vessels where the park service literally just puts a toilet. Right. And then they haul, when winter almost starts, they haul it off with a helicopter. there's a huge composting toilet up at Camp Mir, for example. But it just depends, like, on which, you know, which mountain we're talking about and the jurisdiction. But at Rainier, all the backcountry camps on the Wonderland, they all have pit toilets of some kind.
Are they shielded?
Or some are and some aren't. There's one. There's one on El Dorado.
Yeah,
Cascades. This is climbing, not hiking.
But
it's literally like up on the top of this ridge, and while you're sitting there on the toilet, you can see, I don't even know, hundreds
all the hikers
of,
that are passing
of granitic peaks, and probably dozens and dozens of glaciers. Got to be the most beautiful view from a toilet in the world. off trail in Rainier, they just tell you to, you know, bury it, whatever the regulations are, you know, like 9 inches or 12 inches deep, at least 50 yards from a water source. Typical stuff. Some places, the climbing, so like Mount Hood, you have to have a wag bag, and that makes sense too, like on a Mount Hood, because where you're camping up that high, the soil's not organic, so it won't decompose. It'll just be there, like, and nobody wants to. I mean, do you want to, like, you know, look at a field of human excrement, like, on a climbing trip? You know what I mean? That's the exact opposite of what you're wanting to see and experience. I can't think of any other than climbing where you're way above timberline and the excrement wouldn't break down. I can't think of anywhere that requires wag bags here. Burying is pretty typical, or there's an actual backcountry toilet of some kind.
Yeah. All right. So how do you navigate the challenges and you've done a lot of this for remote or less maintained trails in Washington? Like, what's your whole game plan for that? Cause like, you've done stuff where, like, literally you could die.
Yeah. Yep. So, I mean, all the obvious things of, you know, navigation and making sure that I have the battery that I need, and then, you know, clothing and making sure I have all that, whatever your sun protection plan is and your water plan and all the rest. And then, you know, trip reports can be extremely helpful. I love adventure. But I don't need it to be so adventurous that I'm not willing to read about others' experiences. So, like, definitely read some trip reports to kind of try to understand, like, what it is I'm getting into. I want to understand how hard this is. I don't cope really well when I thought I understood what I was getting into, and then I get there and it's way harder than I thought it was going to be. It's like upsetting, and I don't know. I'd rather over prepare, like, myself mentally and emotionally. So
That was the only time I've ever been broken on a trail is, you know, I thought it was this and it ended up being that. And like I said, forget this. I'm going to hike the 10 miles to the highway and hitchhike.
Yeah.
I'm going back on this thing. But I just wasn't mentally in that space.
That time that I went into the pickets, I experienced that. I was crushed. I mean, I was crushed. I'm not too big to say it, but like, there were literal tears. The picket range, encourage your listeners to Google that and take a gander at some pictures and maybe read some testimonials if you can find some. It's the most remote area in the lower 48. There is no mountain range that's more remote, without going to Alaska. It's very hard to get at. You can't even see it from any road that you can drive on. So it usually involves about a 2-day walk, a long walk, to get up into where the climbing is going to even take place. I read about it and read about it. I mean, I was reading stuff, some stories from the 90s, and then like there were some famous chat rooms that climbers used in the 2000s, prior to social media kind of rising to popularity. And I was like in some old chat rooms from 2004 and 5 and 6, like reading some stories there. But I mean, some of the stuff that you read was just harrowing. Like, people just described it. Even Fred Becky. I mean, most of your listeners probably recognize that name from the movie. A lot of the first descents in the picket range that took place in the 1950s and 60s were Fred and his brother and that whole, you know, that whole gang, that whole group. And they, you know, they talked about it like, well, there's this famous Fred Becky quote about the North Cascades. He says, loveliness in the North Cascades is paid for with the currency of suffering.
I like that.
you want to see North Cascade loveliness? You're free to come, but it's going to cost you a lot of suffering. that's how he described the place. And, I knew going in, this is going to be the hardest thing I've ever done. I knew that. And it was so much harder, Jason, than I thought. Like, it was so much harder than I thought. Yeah. It just kicked our butts.
So when you have these experiences, do you go back and kind of reminisce of what went right, what went wrong, gear choices?
Yep.
You've had some injuries and stuff.
Yeah, with Brandon, we always have a debrief. Usually a few weeks after the fact, we've had plenty of time to think about everything, and he'll come over to our house. We'll have dinner, sit out on the back porch, and we'll always talk about, even on a trip where nothing, you know, went terribly wrong or anything.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about, you know, what different things could we have done different? And there's been a few where it was like, yeah, we made some serious mistakes here. It didn't turn out bad, but there'd been a few of those. One particular one I'm thinking of, this was a climbing trip. Let's see, that was the Isolation Traverse. And the crux of the traverse is a really spicy climb on the backside of Dorado Needle. You cross the McAllister Glacier, and then you got to get up and over Backbone Ridge, and the snow likes to pull away from the granite there, sort of develop like a Bergschrund, like you would get at the top of a glacier. And there was a moat, and then more like headwall, and then another moat, and there was a thin snow bridge that was all sagging and collapsing that we had to cross to get onto the upper headwall, and it was thin. It was really scary. We could have easily fallen through that. So Brandon went through, I was belaying him. He gets up to the top of the moat, and then there was a very spicy down climb that he had to make to get onto the rock face. And he said, "Watch me," which, you know, that command from, you know, learning rock climbing in a rock climbing gym, when somebody says, "Watch me," they're probably about ready to fall, or they might. Yeah. And it was the one and only time I've ever been climbing with Brandon when I ever heard him say those words. And I was just like, holy crap, you know? And we realized, like, had he taken a fall, we had the amount of rope that was run out and everything. If he'd have been hurt or injured or anything, there would be no way for me to get to him. If he was incapacitated and couldn't belay me and he was hurt, I was just effectively separated from him. I was stuck, essentially. There was no way to self-belay. There's no way I could cross that moat without risking my own life. And then we realized our emergency beacon was in his pack. But if something would have happened, I'd be the one that would have needed it.
Oh, man.
And so we realized, like, from now on, like, anytime we're in a situation like that, we need to think about, like, which maybe it even means, you know, transferring it back and forth at times.
No.
It was just a thing that we realized. Nothing ended up coming of it. Like, he successfully did it. And then the next pitch after that is, you'd love this, Jason. It's 5'6" rock, with a fist crack. So it's, you know, an off width, about
yeah.
wide. And then you're putting your fist in and turning it sideways. It's crack climbing. It's like Yosemite crack climbing. But we had just got off the glacier. So we're in mountaineering boots with crampons, you know, full steel crampons. And then we got overnight packs with 6 days worth of food and backpacking gear, climbing gear. So I'm carrying, you know, I got like a 45-pound pack. So we're climbing.
Oh my gosh.
It's a 5'6" pitch, you know, on this inside off width corner up granite to the top of Backbone Ridge, you know, in crampons and a full backpack on. It was like, I was a, I was an alpinist for a few moments in the North Cascades.
Who led that pitch?
Brandon led it, and then I followed it. Yeah, up there on the top, though, man, you could see all the way to Canada, just peaks forever and ever. It was a great moment, but yeah, in briefing, you know, debriefing on the back end, it was like, yeah, we could have done this better, you know, and that's important too, having the humility, right, to be able to say, well, you know, it wasn't like anything terrible happened. But in retrospect, I realize it probably we would have been smarter too.
Man, you know, and I, you know, just listen to the stories on when you come back after some of these things, and just can't believe, like, you know, especially some of the times when you talk about you guys are at the decision point that if we go further, we can't go back.
Yeah, that
if
was
we do this, we yeah. can't go back. Just like that one, like you do this, he gets hurt. There's no going back. You're having to push through.
At the top of that ridge, there's like the top of a rock tower, and there's like a bunch of anchors like wrapped around it. Some of them are like ancient. I mean, they're probably from the 70s. Who even knows?
Wow.
So we put like new anchor cord and stuff, and then we brought a new anchor ring to descend. But then on the descent, once you go up and over the ridge, you rappel down the backside, and that rappel is overhanging. So you... As you're first starting to rappel, you have your feet against the wall, but then you only go down about 5 or 7 feet, and then you're just in open space. And it was like it wasn't huge, but like 80 or 90 feet, you know, rappel down to the glacier on the other side of the ridge. And then once you pull that rope, that's it. There ain't no way back up that way, right? So, and that was that one was a weird feeling, because that was a 60-mile traverse. And that rappel was probably only 15 miles in, you know? So we're 15 miles from this car. We're 35 miles from that car, but now we're committing ourselves. We cannot go back to this one that's closer. We have to go to that one that's further.
That's crazy. Yeah,
emotionally, I know Brandon's pretty even keeled, and it probably doesn't, I don't know. I've never really asked him about the internals of what's happening in his, you know, in his own mind and the privacy of his own mind and what he feels. But for me, like, you know, having nowhere near the experience he has, this boy, those are emotional moments. Like, you just want, you know, he's like, man, this is a serious decision.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I love the story that whenever you guys took Megan, and to the listeners, Megan's John's wife, so she's done some of these crazy things, and she's a very experienced hiker, backpacker, and she's been on the podcast, great podcast, actually. She's actually leading the downloads, but we won't talk about that, right, John? No, but she, you know, she's talking to Brandon, and y'all are crossing a glacier, and she says, hey, Brandon, you know, Brandon's the guide, how do you know, you know, the crevasses, and how do you know which way to go? And he's like, I don't. That's why we're roped in. So if I fall through, you're going to stop me from.
Yeah.
And she's like, what?
Yeah. 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 That was, you know, one of the funnest things, at times it was fun. At times it was interesting. At times it was scary, was just getting to see her, because she had no background of mountaineering, you know. Mm-hmm. Megan hiked the PCT. So she's probably done more backpacking than I have, actually, like in total numbers of hours and nights and stuff. So, you know, living outside was no thing new to her, but climbing was. She had never done it before, ever. And she did a 50-mile traverse called the Ptarmigan Traverse in North Cascades National Park and Glacier Peak Wilderness. That was her very first climbing trip, which is just so funny to me. I mean, it's, you know, it's similar to like never been backpacking, but we're just going to go hike the whole, you know, AT or something.
Yeah.
Like, just jumping in with both feet. But just seeing her experience all those things for the very first time. Was very neat.
So as we kind of start to wrap up, which I really hate to say, but what do you think, what are some of your top recommendations for beginner hikers, just in general, maybe not so much, Texas hikers or Washington hikers, just in general, like what do you think is important to you with, you know, looking back at all your experience and stuff for someone that that's new, that kind of wants to get into this?
Yep. Footwear, like for a novice that's never done this, there's this assumption that, oh, I want to go hiking, so I'm going to go buy hiking boots.
Yeah, no, like, hiking boots. No.
I mean, they do have some applications, and I mean, you own a pair, and there are very specific things that you do from time to time where you want hiking boots, but that's a complete misnomer. You should have good, comfortable footwear with non-cotton socks, like some merino wool or some kind of synthetic socks, and footwear that is comfortable. And it could be hiking boots. I'm not saying, you know, don't use hiking boots, but I'm a big advocate of trail runners. Extremely comfortable. If your feet do get wet, they dry a lot faster. In trail runners, but that's number one. Like, if probably the, you know, you go hiking for your very first time, you've never been before, you want to try it out, probably statistically the thing that's probably going to go wrong is you're going to assume you needed a pair of footwear that you didn't, and you bought them and they weren't broken, and then your feet just end up hamburgered and it hurts and it wasn't fun.
Yes.
And that's not fun. So I would say number one is footwear. Beyond that, you know, like, just get out and hike. Like, go to a state park. Try out a 3 mile hike or a 5 mile hike or something. Yeah. And you know, make sure you have some water. That's super important. I would never ever hike without some water or the ability to get water.
Yeah.
And you know, the ability to purify it. And then a coat. And maybe some food and go for a walk. You don't need to look like an REI model or you know or something.
You don't need
anything wrong with that. I mean, I look like that a lot, but
you don't need all this.
Yeah, don't you don't. I mean, that stuff's nice. I have it as well. But really, the only thing that you actually need is a solid footwear that's comfortable.
Yeah, and you know that's. Also, one thing, like in our journey of hiking and backpacking, we're always learning, right? You're learning as long as you've been doing it. I'm learning as long as I've been doing it. And you're going to make mistakes and you're going to learn, but don't let that stop you. You know, my two biggest things is no water bladder, no hiking boots.
Yeah.
Until you need hiking boots.
A lot can go wrong with water bladders. Yeah. My mother actually ended up, another mom story, but my mom actually ended up severely dehydrated one time. We thought we were going to have to bring her to the stinking emergency room, but she went on a winter hike. And instead of being cloudy and rainy, it was one of those times where it got clear and cold, and her hose froze freaking solid, and she didn't realize it right away. And then when she did realize it, she didn't want to stop and turn around. So she ended up doing this whole entire hike with no water. And then the whole thing ended up just frozen bad. And it was a mess, but yeah, anything with more components becomes, there's more things that can fail. And that's the thing about water bladders is there's just so many different parts of them where things can go wrong.
And it's like, for me, the water bladders, it's not so much the failure. It's, I want to know how much water you have.
I used to use them a long, 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 long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I always hated never knowing how much water I had. That drove me nuts.
Yeah. Like, how much water you have, how much water I have. Like, sometimes I'm the more experienced hiker, so I need to see how much water you have, so I know how to regulate my water you know, like, okay, maybe I don't drink as much just in case they run out. Like, so we need to see each other's water.
Yeah.
So I've started a movement called Stab It. So if you see somebody with a water bladder, just stab it with your knife and show them, like, okay, now filter, now do this, now do that, now collect water. How are you going to do all that?
I don't see them as much as I used to, honestly. I'm just thinking about my local REI up in Olympia, about a half hour north of me. There's like loads and loads and loads of, you know, Nalgene and all that stuff you can buy. And they do still have water bladders. Like, you could go buy one there, but there are definitely far fewer of them in the inventory. So I kind of suspect that we've somewhat turned the corner on those.
No, that's funny. So what is your personal favorite hike in Washington? You know, I was going to ask it.
Yeah, this is not well known. There's two of them, and they're both from the same trailhead, but one is Pinnacle Peak. It gets up into the Tattoos Range on the southern end of Mount Rainier National Park. The trailhead for it is Reflection Lake. Reflection Lake is fairly popular with tourists that don't want to hike. They just want to, you know, park and walk to the edge of the parking lot and take a picture of the thing. There's a famous reflection of where Mount Rainier gets reflected in the water of the lake. And so it's common there, but Pinnacle Peak, I've probably done that hike more than any other hike in my life. I don't even know how many dozens of times I've done that. Sometimes I'm just hiking. Sometimes I'm doing film photography where I'm like really taking my time with a tripod and all that. Other times I'm going up there to climb Plummer or Pinnacle or Denman or various scrambles that you can do up there in the Tattoos Range. And then from the same trailhead, you can go up the Lakes Trail. It goes up towards Paradise. You can actually walk to Paradise from Reflection Lake, but there's a little rock overlook there on the way there that, it's called Faraway Rock, it's just a place that I've been with, brought my son, my, I've been there with my son. I've been there with my daughter, been there with my mom, and it overlooks the Wonderland Trail. Actually, like, you're way up high on a cliff. It's about a 400-foot drop off. There's a lake down at the bottom of the drop off. And then I can actually see the Wonderland Trail as it snakes down the canyon, down Stevens Canyon there. So that's probably my favorite. It's not overly spectacular. It just means a lot to me.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So you just had a pretty massive trip. You got one story that you can share with the listeners on the Wonderland Trail?
Yeah.
Kind of what the Wonderland Trail is. I know what we kind of talked about it before, and then like a story that, like, a most memorable story that you have from it.
Sure. Yeah. So I got a lot of memorable stories of it, but probably going to be the bears on day two. So the Wonderland Trail, as we already mentioned, it's a 93 miles and it goes all the way around Mount Rainier. So you only need one car and you just walk in a big circle till you come back around to your car. not much of it's flat. The high point is 7,000 feet. The low point is 3,000 feet. It's a lot of up and down, a lot of river crossings. Obviously Mount Rainier is a glaciated volcano, so rivers flow out of it from every direction. So you're going down, crossing the river, and then going up and over a pass or a ridge and so forth, and then repeat. We did it early in the season. The reason we did that was it's easier to get a permit. Getting permits to backpack the Wonderland Trail are very difficult to do. I think they say that it's now 10 to 1. So they have for every one person that gets a permit, 10 people apply. So it's hard to get. But if you go early in the year, right when there's still, it's some of it is a little bit like mountaineering and some of it is backpacking. But the snow is still, in place in some places and not in others. It's pretty easy to get permits then. So we deliberately did that. And we started on the east side and we made it all the way around to the southwest. So we did a little bit more than half before we had to get off. Megan was having a lot of neck and shoulder pain. Honestly, it was really just like not training,
not being prepared,
like physically prepared. She was certainly prepared, gear wise and a lot of the other things, but she thought she could kind of just show up and do it.
I'll mute that part of the episode so she won't hear it.
she would admit the same.
Yeah, she did.
And it was funny. We joked a lot about it, right? Because she did just show up and hike the PCT, but there was this little phrase that we kept saying, you're not 22 anymore. You're 32. And the PCT is not the Wonderland Trail.
Yeah.
So two different things there. And then me, I carried way too much freaking camera equipment. I love photography and I carried a ton of analog camera equipment. I was carrying nearly 10 pounds of various film tripods and, and camera gear. So my feet were having a very hard time. But any rate, the one story. So at this particular time of the year, there's only three places that you can access the trail trailheads by car. The other three still were not open yet for the season. We were starting in late June, and the other places were scheduled to open on the 4th of July. So we were just days ahead of the big opening to a lot of these places. So we ended up in sections of the Wonderland Trail that are, you know, normally they would be famous day hikes that you would do, but there was no one there. Just us, like literally just empty. It was kind of strangest feeling. But anyway, around on the northwest side, we're getting ready to go over a pass. And then after you go over the pass, you drop down into a lake basin. And there's actually a road where you can drive up there on the northwest side. This is one of the roads at Mount Rainier that's not paved. So it's a long gravel kind of crappy road. But normally you could drive there, but it's just completely empty at this point in time. As you go up this pass, it's north facing, and it's just choked with vegetation. So it likes to, sometimes in the winter, like severe avalanches will clear everything out. And then you get like these alder thickets and slides and stuff that grow back up in it. And the vegetation is like, I mean, it's weird. Like you're on a trail, but the vegetation is like 15 feet tall. And thick. I mean, thick.
Yeah.
Like, you could be 15 feet from a bear and you couldn't see him. Like, it's thick, tall vegetation. And as we were approaching it, you could kind of see this wall that we're getting ready to go up. It's like super steep. And then it's just switchbacks. And as we're watching, I'm like, there's a bear right there. It's like, whoa, there's another bear. And there's another bear. Oh. And it was just like this field of bears. I don't even know how many there were. Had to have been a half dozen or more, and we're going to have to like walk right through them basically. And we can't see anything once we're in it because the vegetation is so tall. And it was just, I don't know. It was just like highly uncomfortable, and it was a long day. Megan had been in a lot of pain. Everybody's just kind of exhausted. You know, we're mentally exhausted, emotionally exhausted, physically exhausted. We're kind of racing daylight. I really don't want to be pulling the headlamps out to try to get into camp, you know, and making our way through those bears. And then we got to the top and we made it, and Megan had a great big giant smile on her face, and we ended up seeing more bears on the backside. we interrupted a little juvenile bear that was all mad at us that huffed and puffed and threw a fit, but yeah, that was definitely one of my favorite moments from the trip.
Yeah. So did you learn not to carry so much camera gear?
I did. Yeah. Well, here's what, and it was, I knew that Megan was ill prepared for it, and I knew she was gonna have trouble. And in the thinking about that, I just thought of myself as invincible. Like, no. She's going to have a tough time, but I'll be fine.
Yeah.
Right? And I just ended up being stupid. Just plain stupid. I think my pack probably weighed 40 something pounds. I mean, it was similar to what I would carry on a mountaineering trip. But we were trying to do big miles. We had some days that had 5,000 to 6,000 feet of elevation gain, which is a lot. And then my feet just ended up wet a lot because of all the snow that we were constantly in, and the weather went bad. I was hoping for sunshine so that I could dry my feet out, you know, on breaks and stuff like that. And they just stayed wet. I just had wet feet for days. And then that combined with the very heavy pack from all the camera gear. Yep. Just wasn't good.
As a recipe for disaster.
In all my decades of hiking and climbing, this might surprise you, but I've only had blisters twice. Once was one.
Really?
Only two times. Yep. Once was one of the mountaineering traverses that I did with Brandon. I had one blister. I got multiple blisters from the Wonderland this year.
Just because of just being wet?
Being wet and carrying and having too much weight.
All right. Last two questions. Before we go, and it's the questions that I always ask. And we probably touched on some of this stuff, but just to kind of, I don't know, it's tradition. I like to end the podcast with these questions.
Sure.
So, to a new hiker backpacker, what is one piece of gear that you would recommend?
Yeah. The navigation app, just cause we've talked about it so much. Yeah. Those things work phenomenally well, I mean, professionals that are guiding people for a living use those. They're outstanding, but take the time to know how it works.
Okay. And then from a safety aspect, what is one piece of safety advice that you would give to a new hiker backpacker?
Yeah. So same thing, but general and specific is statistics. Yeah. You don't need to be terrified of bears probably, but know where you're going and what the hazards are there. Like, I know strange things happen. Like you could probably die of hypothermia in Big Bend. And I could probably die of heat stroke in the North Cascades, but those are unlikely. Know the specific hazards of the specific place where you're going. Like Washington is way different than Texas. And then specific to Washington, I'm a big believer in synthetic layers.
All right. Well, John, again, thank you so much for taking time out of your Saturday to join the podcast. I'm really excited about this episode, and I know that the listeners will get a lot out of it. And I even got a lot out of it, for my next trip to come visit you and visit Mia. But so I greatly appreciate it. Thanks again.
Oh, man, it's been a blast. Thank you for having me part two.
That's
right. How many guests do you have that have been on twice now?
There's a few just a couple.
Well, I joined the list.
That's right. Yeah, you need to come on. We have a podcast panel. We just sit and talk about hiking. So I definitely want to get you on board.
Oh, yeah.
You have the free time.
I feel like I know a couple of the people, some of these are 2-3 hours and I some of them I've listened to more than once. It's like, man, I need to meet this guy in person.
Yep, absolutely. All right. Well, have a wonderful rest of your day. And thanks again for joining and always supporting the podcast.
Yep. Thanks, buddy.
And that wraps up another exciting episode of the Trailblazing Texas podcast. We hope you enjoyed the episode today and stay tuned for our next episode where we will pick back up where we left off and guarantee to uncover many more hiking gems and share many more tips to enhance your experience on the trail. Until then, happy trails and happy hiking.